Hello and welcome to this special edition of the Saxo Market Call. It's Friday, 19th of November, 2021, and I have with me today, with a bit of a bigger picture view, not just the daily grind of what's going on in the markets at this very moment in time, but a bigger picture view with Stan Jakobsen, Saxo Chief Investment Officer. Stan, I'm glad you could join me for this conversation. I think it's pretty timely. We're seeing a bit of market volatility coming in here. And, you know, as a starting point, I just want to say, for perspective of where it seems to me you are these days, and that is distinctly uncomfortable with the backdrop here. I've known you for a long time, and I've recalled in the past the times when you are often earlier. You're early to get uncomfortable, maybe a bit like Soros's backaches before the market starts to have some issues. And so I'm feeling that from you now. And I just wanted to maybe get through into your head and get you to describe what it is you're seeing in this market that makes you uncomfortable, where things are priced and what the narrative is out there.
Natural starting point would have been to say that the market is extremely expensive, but that's actually not what makes me the most uncomfortable. What makes me seriously concerned and sleepless to some extent is the fact that all the smart people I talk to in the world is now engaged in two things only. One is to play the crypto market as we used to do when I was a young trader, dollar mark. Now it's all crypto. So if you are a trader who has a high frequency fund or asset management business, right now you're spending about 50% of your time on crypto. The second part being that all of these people has also at the same time retired from public the public domain to some extent. They don't trade any title, no company in the space that you and I occupy together with Peter Gonry and the equity investors. They simply have moved over to the private equity side. And what that signals to me is, one, of course, the starting point again, that the public market and that public market here being all the listed companies are too expensive or too difficult to actually navigate. It's a much better return game and risk game to be involved in something like 100% crypto volatility and a private equity with all that illiquidity that is built into that framework. And this trend is not new or immediate. It's something that's been going on, in my opinion, over the last 18 months, that increasing amount of people who has been macro players like myself for a long time, they have simply given up trying to both understand the market, but also to play the market and have moved on to something else, which is primarily, as I just said, private equity and crypto. And you know, nothing wrong with that because, of course, they're doing it because there's an excess return in that space. But it's also, I just alluded to, 100% volatility in crypto and private equity. You know, when shit hits the fan, it's going to be a difficult exercise to take yourself out of that game overall. So those, John, are my major concerns. And then all of a sudden, of course, you ping me yesterday and you show me your risk model, which hasn't been signaling a negative reading for a long time. And then all of a sudden that comes up. Brenda Donnelly, a good friend of both of us, writes an amazing newsletter paper, is out saying that, you know, there is this anecdotal but still important thing that every time sports stadiums in the US is named after the yes. Crescent trend, then there's, I mean, everybody remembers City Stadium and whatever.
I'm from Houston, Texas. We had Enron Field, if you'll not forget that one, which was just before a small situation there. But yeah, you're right. I meant to actually mention that on the podcast recently. It was just yesterday. The crypto.com paying $700 million for the rights to the I guess it's the Lakers and Clippers basketball arena.
Yeah. So that's the combination, and a lot of the listeners will say, "Oh, this is just an old guy who doesn't understand anything." But I am distinctly discomfortable about the whole outlook and the way the market trades, and in particular because now we're coming into that part of the season where there are no liquidity in the sense that a lot of the market maker has retired the pool of capital available for market making, and that means that we set ourselves up for what could be a disruptive market into the year.
Yeah, and what you're saying there as well, and you're seeing news items sort of harmonizing with that, something like the whole market ecology is changing in a couple of ways. So ecology meaning the different, you know, bits and pieces that feed off of the system. Some of them simply aren't there anymore. One of those that has been prominent in recent news is the absence of short sellers to a degree. Some of these have been barbecued essentially by the relentless rises. And as well, the leveraged players out there and the whole behavior around options, which is clearly these derivatives market is often the tail that is wagging the market dog. We saw some recent monthly patterns that were clearly linked to the monthly expiry of options for the S&P. And as well, we're seeing some individual stocks options trading in amounts that are, 150% of the underlying markets, Tesla, names like Tesla, Amazon, et cetera. So I agree with you. There's a very different ecology out there and a very different market that's unlike anything that we've seen in our years in the market. And you mentioned the risk model, and a note of caution there. It is just a risk model that picks up a few measures of market volatility, as well credit spreads. When things get quiet, the moving averages tend to settle, and therefore, when things start to decline a bit, it shows a negative reading. But we are seeing some volatility picking up here into year end, and a lot of that is driven by FX. And I think you would agree with me, Stane, that a strong dollar is not something that makes the global markets comfortable. Do you have any views on at what point this strong dollar becomes a bigger issue for markets?
I think the dollar is already a big issue because if we shy away from the Western world and look to the emerging market, we see dollar SAR making new highs. We see dollar Brazil, we see dollar Turkey, we see a number of the emerging market currencies under severe pressure. And that is pretty classical dollar story in the sense that there are two growth engines in the world. There's the US, and then the opposite of that is the emerging market. So either the US is accelerating in growth or the rest of the world is. What's interesting right now is that both of them seems to be decelerating at the same time, which is massively unusual in a sense, because normally a stronger dollar comes with a cyclical fiscal spending and probably an easing of monetary policy. But what we have right now is a tightening relatively. I admit it is not a tightening in a classic sense, but it's a relative tightening of the monetary policy stance, and the fiscal remains at best slightly diluted to what we expected at least 6 and 9 months ago. And then on the other hand, you have the emerging market, which should be benefiting from very high energy resource price overall, but that is being held back by it seems a number of course ESG initiatives, the repositioning, and overall that country like China is slowing down dramatically. So it is probably the first time in many cycles that we see that the market is acting out very, very differently. And to some extent, something that should be opposing each other is now coinciding in terms of its impact. And that also makes me concerned because, as I said a few times in internal meetings, if you look at Europe, the stock market trading at all-time high in Europe, but we are deficient in energy. We cannot supply enough energy to ourselves to save our lives. We are now depending on what side of the bed that Putin wakes up in. We're deficient on military. We cannot fight for ourselves. Just take the Danish military. They still have equipment from the 1950s roaming around, which they're trying to find spare parts for. And we are deficient in the decision making, which we lately saw, of course, during the rollout of the vaccine. Ultimately, they got it right, but it took a hell of a long time relatively to both the UK and the US to get initiated on this process, which was down to, having to discuss in 22 different subgroups how to do this. So we're deficient in Europe, we're deficient overall, and I think that's where the world is going. I mean, it's not maybe a little bit of a teaser here, but the rate prediction is called revolution, and I think we are moving fast forward toward a market condition which almost begs an explosion in volatility under the headline that we have disruption and revolution going on, both in the amount of products, but also, as you say, in the underlying ecology of the overall system.
Yeah, and just for listeners who are not entirely sure what we're talking about, the outrageous predictions being our yearly exercise and coming up with 10 predictions that are not meant to be sort of, that we see as high expectations of happening, but things that are surprisingly high delta relative to the virtual zero delta that the market is assigning the likelihood of these events and then what that could mean if such a thing were to happen. And these will be out shortly, so stay tuned for those in the week or two ahead. And we'll be, of course, we'll be hosting a podcast or two on those outrageous predictions. I wanted to move back to one thing because you mentioned we're in a tightening cycle, and we have seen quite a shift in the forward expectations from the Fed. We have not seen a shift really at the long end of the U.S. yield curve, but that the sort of where the Fed operates, which is in the next couple of years space. But aren't we still talking about some fairly weak beer here. I mean, we're looking at a CPI that just reached 6.2%. The Fed's core PCE measure, the latest one, is going to be out next week, expected at 4.1%, which would be a 30-year high for the core PCE reading. Yes, it's a monthly print, but it's very, very elevated. How big do you think this policy mistake could get if as we expect, this inflation outlook proves not to be transitory? And what would that mean to just on a vaguely, what kind of scale of tightening do you think is possible if the Fed realizes its mistake?
The best way to answer that simplistically, of course, is to look at the real rates, which is, as you say, if you subtract 6.2%, which is the going rate in CPI, from the present, 2 year, which is trading at
75
basis points, right? So then you have a real rate of -5.5%, minus 550 basis points, which sits up against...
45 basis points. I was looking at the expected... So 45 basis points only.
The point being, it's 500-600 basis points negative versus a market that says it's still 125 basis point minus. The reality is we are significantly lower. And then the question, of course, begs, which of the two is right? And I don't think anyone listening to Saxo is in any doubt that I've been an inflationist since Q2, Q3 last year. So, of course, I think the inflation is real. Also because the business I do on advisory and boards and the likes indicates very clearly that this phenomena will stay at least through 22, but also, in my opinion, through 23 minimum, and create additional havoc in terms of the market. But back to the actual market and the pricing, what's going on right now is that, of course, we have moved to transitory to temporary. But what I find hugely surprising is that, Bank of America does this survey of all the fund managers that they can find, and they survey them once a month. And in the latest edition of this report, which came out earlier this week, it is still 70% of all the fund managers thinks that inflation is transitory. So either they are just buying the narrative that comes from the central bankers and the governments, or they decided that they want to close their eyes and just hope for the best, which, of course, they should do in churches and not in the markets. But I think there's a huge awakening call coming up. And I think last time on your broadcast, I said that we will have a 7% print in CPI. And of course, we're getting very close to that. So if 6.2 or 7% print in CPI cannot get people to move away from a position of transitory, I think we need some breakdown in the system to happen. And that breakdown, in my opinion, is that energy crisis, which is brewing around the corner, not only in Europe, not only in China, but also in, ultimately in the US. We see a deficiency in the ability and the storage of energy. We see the distilled products being under pressures, and we see something like LNG, which is, in energy terms, is the marginal input-output that can be done and escalated up and down, increasing in price almost every single day. So we will have a full-fetch energy crisis this winter, and that energy crisis will, of course, in itself elevate the CPI and the inflationary aspect, but more importantly, it would leave out and force businesses to close down, and will probably ultimately mean a huge tax on that amount of money that's been given to maintain the purchasing power. I think negative purchasing power is a reality, in particularly in the US, and that again will translate into both higher inflation in terms of compensation, but also a political nightmare as we move into the midterm election in 2020.
And it's the worst of all worlds for a central bank, which has formerly been the master of the universe, but then they're sort of not able to provide any policy that's relevant with such a backdrop.
But I think the point is, John, that you and I can disagree with the consensus. The consensus, as per the Bank of America manager survey, is that 70% thinks it's transitory. So before that number starts to come below 50, I don't think we will see a massive impact on the market. So we are, as per usual, sitting down waiting for something to evolve. I think what will evolve, of course, is the season. And the season will bring colder weather and more focus on the energy inefficiency that we have in the world. And that in itself means de facto that we will see rising energy prices, rising electricity prices. And that will be the eureka moment for the 70% of people in that fund manager survey who continue to think this is transitory. Because winter is transitory, it does go away in the spring. To quote a very famous movie with Peter Sellers, the gardener, after winter comes spring, but the impact of it will sit through most of 22, and that forces central banks to move ahead in terms of the hike. And we've seen, of course, primarily the hawkish part of the Federal Reserve move to that position. St. Louis Fed's governor is out saying that they may even have to hike rates before ending the QE, a position that we've seen by the Bank of England take before, and then they, decided to do the opposite. But ultimately, we are in a position right now where the market over the course of Christmas and into the early part of Q1 will be forced to acknowledge the fact that the Fed and the central banks globally are so far behind, because exactly this conversation we just had, that inflation is staying put, and the second round effects in terms of higher wages is for everyone to see and coming through.
Yeah, and I guess to emphasize your point, if you look at the forward expectations for the Fed, even though we've seen quite a slide here and move in terms of bringing forward when the Fed might hike and raising that sort of 1 to 1.5 years out where they may get to, the sort of terminal perceived ceiling for Fed rates is still around 2%. I mean, all the way out to, like, we're talking 2027 here, and there's almost no differentiation from 2025 to 2027. So I guess I would emphasize or underline your point that the market simply believes the Fed can't get above that level without, I suppose, crashing the economy and therefore bringing down the risks that would feed a higher policy rate. So it's a pretty dramatic macro bet out there, I guess you could argue, on how the Fed perceive, or sorry, how the market perceives the future course of Fed policy. And then at the, by this on this, at the same time, I guess it feeds the rational narrative around here, which is that as long as those long-term yields are pinned so low, and as you mentioned, negative real rates, it's a huge dilemma. Do you put your money in cash or in bonds that yield less than inflation? No, there's no alternative, Tina. You put them in equities. But so there is a rational narrative, but I wonder how long it can extend. And I guess you could say, well, it'll extend as long as these negative real rates continue
Not
to drop.
only that, but if you look from if you're a corporate or a listed company and you're operating a financial model, what is interesting is that the propensity or the correlation with interest rates are negatively on your business is slightly delayed. And the reason it's delayed is that as the equity price is going up, the equity capital goes up in these companies, which means they can refinance and renegotiate a big part of the borrowing they have at better rates. So yes, the marginal cost of capital in terms of the old benchmark of LIBOR is going up, but the overall spread is coming down because simply the stock market has been on such a ride that the incremental value or the internal value of a company has risen in the valuation of a credit risk, and through the credit risk, you then reduce the spread. So you can argue that in the early parts of a rising spread, what you tend to see is that the companies that are willing, able, and wanting to do this can renegotiate to a lower refinance rate. But after that, then the spread starts to come out. And that's exactly what we've seen. And then maybe, one of the last signs I've been looking for, if you look at some of the ETF that reflects the spread products, as we call credit, because they trade as a spread up against the money market rates. If you look at those rates, the HYG, the HYG, and the JNK, the junk ETF, those are starting to give way on the downside, meaning that the spreads are increasing in that space. And that's the first movement we've seen through this massive inflation rise combined with the now priced in, as you say, terminal rate staying the same, but the front end of the curve being aggressively priced to higher and more hikes. So, watch the credit space for this, because that is the, yeah, it's the muscle. If there was a muscle, it's the most, it has the best elasticity, the best ability to be flexible. But even that muscle is tightening up somewhat, not right now.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned that, because in connection with that, with my global risk model that I created in the wake of the global financial crisis, which it was far more relevant for than has proven the case since then. It's still a very relevant indicator, but one of the key things that was so glaringly obviously back then was that credit was screaming pain well before the actual, everything hit the fan, basically, starting late in 2007 to well before that. And then especially into 2008, there was a very clear, massive deterioration in credit heading into that. And the spooky thing has been a couple of the episodes we've had more recently. So back in 2018, for example, when we first had the so-called apocalypse, and then later on the big declines in the market, and the market was spooked by the Fed tightening as much as it did, you really didn't get any advance warning from credit. So I'm wondering if credit is a bit coincident, but of course we have to watch it no matter what, but still it is a shoe that needs to drop before you have a proper, a situation on our hands. But it scares me to the degree to which it hasn't proven very prescient in recent market cycles. Let's move over a little bit to something that could be happening before people even listen to this podcast, because it could be happening today, any day now, and that is new Fed chair. I think we've pretty much thoroughly covered this. Do you think there's much of a difference medium term beyond some very brief, almost algorithmic style reaction to the announcement, or whether we get a Fed chair Brainard or a Fed chair Powell for a second term starting next February?
The way to go about on a question like that, I think, is to look into history. So, I could ask you, is there a big difference between the way Bernanke runs the Fed and Powell and Yellen and Greenspan? And of course, the resounding answer to that, absolutely major differences. But is the difference then in the policy they pursue or the way they do the business of running the Fed? And I think, at least to me, John, I think the way they run the Fed, the way they create a consensus is very, very different from the different Fed chairs that we've seen. And I think that is my main point between Brainard and Powell. Powell is a lawyer. Brainard is a trained economist. Biden's advisor on this is his economic council chief, which comes from a background of ESG climate-related jobs in his very young, has to be said, he's a very young guy, but he's been working in that space. So, if they run this on a ideological political platform, trying to cater to the radical left, then clearly Brainard is a shoe-in. To be honest, my opinion personally is that it would be an absolute scandal if she's not appointed. Not because I favor Brainard over Powell, but simply I think the management with the governors who's been trading their own accounts and the likes, it's a major breach of fiduciary responsibility on the Fed chair. And overall, I think his ability to navigate the U.S. economy and the Fed balance sheet out of this coming, despite a long, long, long tradition and history in financial markets, I don't think he conceptually understands that we need a paradigm shift. I mean, the Fed famously abandoned inflation targeting 2 years ago, and ever since the inflation has been going up. So now they need to either reestablish the credential on inflation, or they need to figure out another way to increase productivity in the US society. So we need to go away from how relevant the next two hikes is relevant to how do the Federal Reserve become a supportive part of the US economy. You don't do that through a full employment mandate. You do that through making sure there is a price discovery in the market. The market has an access, an angle to grind and allocate capital to all of the markets, not just the public traded titles, but also the private equity, to the SME in particular, who remains 80% of any economy. So I think Fed and Powell has done a very good job for the listed companies. And I think they've done a huge disservice to the SMEs and the people who actually run America on a daily basis. And you, as an American, will, I'm pretty sure, support me in this, that if you live in a city outside Houston or outside New York, what is going on there is thousand upon thousand of SMEs relatively to the IBMs and the Facebook and the likes as employers. That makes a huge difference to the U.S. society. And they've been left behind by this policy, which has been the trickle-down effect and keeping the big title companies alive relative to the SMEs. So there needs to be a focus change. And, long answer to your question, but basically I think there is a huge difference in style, and Brainard will be seen as the stepchild of Elizabeth Warren. And of course, Elizabeth Warren has been very, very anti-Powell and the whole stance of the Federal Reserve. So if she's a, you know, a stepchild of Warren, I think we can expect increased regulatory scrutiny. And on top of that, I think you know, no one can be more dovish than Powell. Anyone that claims that Mark Brainerd could be more dovish is
Well, she never dissented from any opinion when Powell was hawkish, and then when he made the switch to dovish, she always voted
For me,
the
she's not
majority.
an ideological person like that. She's not someone who wants to stand out, and so she's a political operative that operates inside this new climate, ESG, full employment, and the inefficiency of the policy that needs to be conducted. So you will have probably more of a Yellen, who was a labor economist type of organization, probably an organization that gets tighter in terms of the board's decision, but also a board that needs to face existential questions like, you know, the paradigm of full employment versus the mandate on inflation is too far apart right now, and we are focused too much on full employment. Full employment is something the economy takes care of, while the inflation traditionally has been something central banks take care of. But for some reason, Powell decided to take the Fed down the path of being a, as he called it, part of the solution for ESG, climate, world poverty, and employment, which is not a mandate of the Federal Reserve.
That
So
was
if I was
the argument as well of the Weimar Republic, was making sure the worker stayed in work, and that was one of the drivers ideologically of
your
printing money.
analogy, not mine, John, but I'm just saying that
No.
case of ECB and the Federal Reserve, we've seen a massive dilution of this original mandate. And I think you can even argue that if someone wanted to take them to court, they are in blatant violation of the original mandates of these institutions, which is to provide liquidity and to provide you know, money to the system to make it run smoothly inside a controlled inflationary target. Now that mandate has changed 180 degrees to something which is socioeconomics and philosophical rather than practical. And of course, the beauty of that for a central bank is that it's very hard to pin them down on anything which is philosophical and social. Just look at politicians. Whereas on the facts-based 6.2%, you know, I can say that 50 times in a row, just to make people understand, 6.2% is a massive inflation rate. Whether it's transitory or not, it is a massive problem for the low-income group in the U.S., and the purchasing power is being eroded day by day, and it will get worse because we're now having an energy crisis that we can add to this equation and very blatantly a volatile cocktail.
All right, let's to round off the discussion here. I just want to switch over to Europe because the situation in Europe is we've alluded to it a little bit already with the situation here, but it is certainly an area, an economy, and a political framework that leaves me uneasy and has for years. Looking, we had a, you know, a big wave of optimism around Europe around 2017, but to me, that there's a time that Europe has started to look a bit darker in terms of the uncertainties of going forward. It's now part of this natural gas situation, the economic outlook, the German coalition. How do you see Europe shaping up in this very dark winter at the moment? Hopefully it doesn't you know, get worse with the price of power and gas. And then as we get into the political environment into 2022.
I think it's the single biggest challenge for the EU framework that we've seen since Draghi famously came out and said, whatever it takes to save the euro. But now we are not out to save the euro. Now we are out to save the whole system. Because, you know, the energy situation put us in a spot which is non-negotiable and cannot be solved by easier monetary policy or, let me remind you, Mrs. Lagarde telling the market that what she thinks. This is about the inability to feed the power grid, is in the ability to transact into that vibrant story of electric vehicles going to solve all of the CO2 emission problems in the world. So, you know, the premise is wrong, the execution is wrong, and the ability to change is zero because the political landscape in Europe looks like we're turning increasingly left. As some of the listeners will know, Copenhagen, the biggest city, the capital city in Copenhagen, just has the Communist Party becoming the biggest vote gainers in the local election last this week. Same has happened in Austria, in Graz, and a few other places. So what we can foresee into the next 2 to 5 years is that the more green, more ESG will be put on the table and will be substantiated with a huge amount of support financially and incentive-wise. And it's not going to solve the practical problem of keeping the turbines at the utilities running at a constant rate, which is really the physical issue here, John. So that's number one. So the energy will create this kind of crisis. But to some extent, you can see this in a positive and a negative way. The positive aspect here being that this financial crisis can, make people aware this is an issue, and then we can relate and deal with that exact issue becoming better in terms of the green bonds being replaced by, grid network bonds, which is a specific cause and root of the problem we have right now. So we can reduce the dependency on Russia. We will probably have to have a reclassification of certainly atomic power, but probably also natural gas into the green space to facilitate the time gap between now and 2035, 2040, when we want to be green. I don't think anyone disagrees with the aspiration of where we want to be in 35 and 40. I think everyone needs to rethink how we get to 35 and 40 without blowing up the economy. And that is what Europe is at risk, because if you're deficient in energy, deficient in military, and deficient in political power, you are the last, you are bottom of the league. If this was a football league, this is the equivalent of having 2 points and no games to play in terms of what goes on. So the saving grace of Europe would be to move to, being part of the solution in terms of increased investment into using the strong entrepreneur and engineering efforts that we have in Europe to come up with a solution that can be exported out of Europe into the rest of the world, so we can get China to reduce the CO2, to get US on board. But right now, we have relegated ourselves to think about the amount of electric vehicles on the road as a success criteria for where we are. That's not the case. It's a global problem that needs to have a global solution. And right now, we're in Europe just focused on being the kid in the class with the cleanest hands after the lunch break.
Yeah, I set that up as the last question, but actually, just where the markets are as we're speaking, I think there's something very interesting going on. And I want to ask you one final question before we wrap this up. And that is, with your background, very extensive background in foreign exchange, you've seen the Japanese yen at the center of some pretty significant market volatility events over the years. I think given where the narrative has been recently, and that we're seeing a little bit of credit issues creeping into the market here, we've got COVID shutdowns happening today in Austria. Maybe in Germany, they're saying they can't rule out a COVID lockdown. Yen volatility is suddenly coming alive. And this is just something, I'm in foreign exchanges as well. And I've seen a few of these yen cycles as well. Do you think the yen is in the wrong place here potentially? And just maybe give listeners a perspective on why the Japanese yen can be so important. To my mind, it's a lot of it has to do with capital flows. The fact that Japanese savings sloshing around the world is a huge factor in global markets. But is there any, or do you have any thoughts on the Japanese yen, basically, is my long way of asking the question.
Yeah, so China, sorry, Japan has been a capital exporter since the 1970s. So in simple terms, they have excess savings, which they send overseas in terms of buying US bonds. And they are still to this day the single biggest financier of ships, airplanes, and anything to do with logistics and infrastructure. So they are capital exporters. That also means indirectly that they have the least financial leverage as a country, not in terms of its bond market and the relative size of the economy, but in terms of its current account, which of course is the balance of net savings, they have the least amount of leverage. So in a world that becomes increasingly uncertain, what you tend to see is that surplus countries on the capital flow side, i.e. countries that have a current account surplus, does better. And no one does better on current accounts than Japan, and has a long history. On top of that, of course, old foreign exchange hands like yourself and I, John, we know that from experience. So something like Aussie yen and dollar yen is always the canary in the coal mine for us in terms of the volatility. I think what's going on in the currency space right now is that the currency space has been left behind as one of the few places where you have a price discovery. I think you made an excellent point in one of the broadcasts this week. They're saying that, the bond market in Europe is not, if cannot be used to express a unhappiness with Europe anymore, because basically the ECB buys everything and supports it, but the currency still can reflect the dissatisfaction that we have with the euro. Similarly, with the yen, just the opposite way around. If we are dissatisfied with the overall risk level, you will tend to see that the yen will strengthen. So one of the signs we need to see, of course, is that this very big dollar yen will reverse into a sell-off and ultimately take out some of the levels that you very well describe on a weekly basis going on. But this time it's more about the deficiency of Europe than it is the strength of the yen. So of course, euro yen is probably the more interesting play on the downside here to monitor. But let me say this, that in a crisis where you have a tightening dollar, one or two things can happen. You can have some liquidity provision enabled from the Federal Reserve in terms of giving more dollars to the rest of the world, but if there's a lag of that, we will see what happened in February and March of 2020, which is that the only valid currency in the world to trade is the US dollar and in your account. So cash dollars in the accounts as a transaction is what people go to when they see an increase in risk. So I think the listeners needs to not listen to you and me, but they need to focus on the euro dollar and the euro yen as a proxy for how nervous the world is. And as this week certainly have seen a breakdown, in my opinion, a big breakdown in the euro dollar and in the euro yen. I think that needs to be monitored and just adds on to where we started this conversation about the number of indicators that into itself is not enough to be negative on the market, but as a combination says to you, at least an old man like me, that now you have to be extremely alert and aware of what goes on in the marketplace.
As we're speaking here, apropos to what you're saying and your great points there, we have the euro yen sitting right on the well-defined range lows around 128 and just below. Those have been the lows since early March of this year. So we'll have to watch that. We'll have to watch how the markets shape up here. It's looking a bit more nervous as we're heading into the weekend on these latest COVID lockdown announcements. Stane, thanks for your time. We'll call that a wrap for today. And then we'll be back with our normal broadcast, of course, every day next week.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter at Saxo Market Call or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.